A Biblical Theory of Marriage. The first talk in a series titled Love, Sex, and Marriage was presented by Larry Barber on March 29, 2005, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
I want to make some introductory comments, kind of let you know what I'm going to do, and then I'll do it. I'm going to talk about a theory of marriage. Hopefully it's a biblical theory of marriage. And I'm going to start out by talking about what marriage is not. I'm going to talk about the myth of marriage and the myth of faith. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about what marriage is, that marriage is a gift, that God is responding to some relational needs that He's created in us. And it's also a gift in that He is responding to an internal need, and He is using marriage primarily for the purpose of sanctification as opposed to fulfillment. So that's kind of where I'm going. I think there's a lot that could be said about marriage that I'm not going to say. I'm not going to be exhaustive at all. I'm going to emphasize a particular aspect of marriage, and I hope that that perspective will help both people who are married and people who are single as well. Over in the last 8 or 9 months, I've had an opportunity to officiate a couple weddings, and it's given me the opportunity to think about marriage, what it's about, think about my own experience in marriage and what I've learned and what it's been like. And so I'm going to talk about part of that, and that's part of what I bring to what I'm going to say tonight. I was thinking about this today, and I'm not sure if I was back 27 years, Mike, Christine and I have almost been married 27 years now, and if I was in the audience here tonight and about to hear what I'm going to say, I'm not sure that I really would have understood it. I'm not sure that I would have really understood what God was about and how He was going to use my marriage. I'm not sure that I would have understood that I was going to fail as badly as I've failed, and as often as I failed. I don't know that I would have gotten that. I was happy to be getting married, and I was very much in love with Christine. I'm still very much in love with Christine. Watch how I say that. But I don't really think that I understood what God was about with marriage at all. And I know that I remember that Christine and I asked questions about marriage to people who have been married a while, and I don't know that they got it either. And so I hope you get it. I hope that this makes sense to you and that it's helpful to you. So I also understand that this audience, there's a lot of single people here, and I hope that this is someday that if you get married that this perspective will be helpful to you if you're single. One of the things that I'm going to say is that I think that God's purpose in marriage is sanctification, that it's really not primarily about fulfillment, though it does meet a lot of needs that God has created in us. Primarily, God's intent is to use marriage for sanctification. That raises the question. I mean, around here, the question will be asked, well, is marriage something unique or special in terms of, is a single person, or is God limited by a person's singleness? And I would say absolutely not. But there is a qualitative difference about being married and being single. And God uses marriage in ways that it's not possible with single people. That's not to say that limits God in any way at all. Okay? And if you have questions about that, at the end when I'm done talking, we can talk about that. I want to start out by talking about what marriage is not and talk about the myth of marriage. Myth is a belief that is not founded in reality. Yet in spite of that fact, we cling to it. We hold on to it. We hope in it. We hope that it's true. And the reason that we hope that it's true is because we want to believe that it's true. We want it to be true. And in spite of the fact that it's not true, we still believe it. There are several myths about marriage, and I'm going to focus on one particular myth. And that is a myth that's prevalent in our culture, and that is the idea that if we marry the right person, that we will find happiness. Happiness means having our emotional and physical needs met. It means having a marriage that isn't so hard. But part of our wanting happiness and wanting life to not be so hard comes out of our brokenness. As fallen people, we don't really always want what is right. We don't always even know what is right or what is good. At best, we're conflicted about this. And part of our being conflicted is that we want to be comfortable. And sometimes we'd rather even choose comfort over what is hard, what is difficult. In our Christian culture, we have constructed a spiritualized version of this myth. We've listened, many Bible teachers tell us that more than anything else, God wants us to be happy in this present life. He wants to meet all our needs. He wants us to live life abundantly. They tell us that marriage is one of the more important and crucial gifts that God can use and that God has given us to bring about happiness. They tell us that the goal of marriage is fulfillment, and that's what God has in mind with marriage. Foundational to this pursuit or this pursuit of happiness in marriage and fulfillment in marriage is the myth of faith. And let me talk about that for a second. The myth of faith is the belief that faith in Jesus is the essential ingredient to having a successful, fulfilling marriage. The myth goes something like this. If we truly have faith in Jesus, then God will meet our emotional and physical needs through this other person. By success, we mean that life will go relatively smoothly, that there will be harmony in the relationship, evidenced by an absence of conflict. We'll have great sex. We will live moderately successful in our endeavors, vocationally and financially. We'll raise great children who are respectful and who don't get in trouble. That's how our culture thinks about success and fulfillment in marriage. And faith is this ingredient that brings that about. We've been taught that faith is a state of consciousness, a feeling of dependency. And that state is the mechanism that empowers a person to live a successful life. Faith is seen as the crucial ingredient that opens the door for the Holy Spirit to do His work. And then enabling, actually, me not to sin. If I have genuine faith, then God will empower me to resist sin in my life. Faith is believed to be the feeling that empowers my ability to make right choices and obey God. I obtained this state of consciousness or this feeling of dependency by participating in daily devotions and prayer and worship at church. This myth also teaches us that the evidence of our faith is that we get our needs met. It's kind of circular. If we have faith, we can be confident that we are marrying the right person, that we are in God's will, and everything kind of flows out of that. If we do not get our needs met, then it's because we don't have faith or we lack a certain degree of faith. And we sort of need to find a way to ratchet up our faith a little bit so that we get our needs met. I believe that this is an inaccurate view or understanding of the biblical view of faith. I don't think that's what the Bible means when it says or talks about faith. The Bible does not present faith as a state of consciousness or a feeling of dependency or a mechanism that empowers me for successful living. It is not the product that results from observing certain religious disciplines. Rather, faith from a biblical perspective, and I'm going to read this again so you can all get this because it's important. Faith from a biblical perspective is the personal commitment to the teaching of the Bible, which I have come to be persuaded is an accurate reflection of reality. I demonstrate my personal commitment in my choices. Let me read that again. Faith from a biblical perspective is the personal commitment to the teaching of the Bible, which I have come to be persuaded is an accurate reflection of reality. And that I demonstrate that commitment in the choices that I make. So faith is not something that I have more or less of. Either I'm personally committed to the truth of something or I'm not. For example, if I'm committed to the idea or the truth or the belief that it's good and right to be a forgiving person, what that means then is that when someone actually hurts me, that I will strive to actually forgive them. Now, the emphasis there is on striving. It doesn't mean I'm going to do it perfectly because I'm committed to this particular belief. It means that that's the direction my life is going. That's what I want. That's what I believe is good. Having faith does not mean that I'm not going to sin. Again, faith is not this mechanism that guarantees successful living. Faith is what I have come to believe and personally am committed to is true. That's what faith is. Okay, you see the distinction that I'm making here? I might even believe that to forgive, in the case of forgiveness, I might believe that forgiveness means to forget. And if I believe that, then I'm going to strive to forget because that's my belief, and that belief will be demonstrated in the choices I make about forgiveness. I might believe that forgiveness is about getting even. And if I believe that, then I'm going to strive to get even because that's what I'm personally committed to. That will be a reflection of my faith or what I believe. Marriage is one of those intensely personal classrooms that God has given us in order to graphically demonstrate to us what we are really committed to. As we live out marriage, we get to see it. We get to see it in ourselves. We get to see as I interact with Christine, I get to see what it is I believe. I also get to see that I am a sinner, and even my personal commitment to goodness or truth doesn't guarantee that I'm going to get it right. So I get to see that I need mercy as well. And that's part of the classroom, that's part of what God intends to teach me in the classroom of marriage. There are a couple problems with this myth. First of all, we cling to this myth because of marriage and faith, because we don't want to believe what God says about us is true. We want to believe different of ourselves. We want to believe better of ourselves. It's hard for us to face the truth about ourselves that we can actually be hurtful as we really can. That's why I said earlier that I don't know, if someone had said this to me 27 years ago, I don't know that I would have got it. I don't know that I was at that point as capable of being as hurtful as I really am. I don't know that I would have seen that then. I don't know that I was ready to see that back then. But God has brought me along, and he has used marriage slowly in this process of showing me that and teaching me that. And I get clearer and clearer about that. I don't know that I would have actually wanted marriage. I mean, don't take that wrong. But I don't really know that I was ready for that back then. I don't know that I would have wanted it the way that I want it now, the way that I want goodness now. I don't know that I would have wanted it back then. Okay. This myth that faith in Jesus empowers me to have a fulfilling, successful marriage also seduces me into believing that I'm really better than I really am. And it gives me a false hope in myself, and that's unfortunate. I'm going to read a quote here from Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He's written a book called Life Together. And there's a section in his book called An Ideal But Not a Reality. And it's a powerful section. And in it, he writes about people having wish dreams. And a wish dream is kind of synonymous with a myth. It's the same thing. It's the same idea. And he's writing about communal living, and obviously marriage is communal living as well. But he says that God is committed to shattering such dreams and myths. He won't let us have them. He says it actually wrecks and ruins real community, real communal life. He goes on to say that it is God's intent that we be overwhelmed by a great disillusionment with others, with Christians in general, and if we are fortunate with ourselves, that's God's intent in communal living. So we've talked a little bit about what marriage is not. It's not this myth that we have about marriage in our culture and in our Christian culture is really not founded. And we've talked about this issue of faith and how that's not, I don't think that's a biblical perspective. So the purpose of marriage is not fulfillment. So what is marriage about? I think it's about two things, and I'm going to talk about those two things. First, I think it is a gift from God that responds to relational needs that God has actually created in us. That's not to say, or that's not a commitment on God's part to say that we're going to get all our needs met. So that's different from what we were talking about a minute ago about faith and how faith works or doesn't work. And then secondly, it is, where is it? It is, marriage is authored by God to address this eternal need that we all have. Okay. So let me talk about it's a response of God to address relational needs that he's created in us. Marriage is this amazing, wonderful gift that is given to us by God. It offers the possibility of living together with another person who is similar but different. It offers the possibility of living together rather than alone. And God is creating us this need for connection. It presents the possibility of being seen, of being heard, of being known, of being cherished, of being wanted. Over time, marriage allows us to build a shared history with another person. It offers the opportunity for touch, the deepest of communication, welcome, comfort, encouragement. It offers refuge and emotional support when life is hard. It provides the opportunity to walk alongside another person who intimately knows me and can help me see what I don't see because I'm too close to it. It offers the opportunity and the experience of forgiving and being forgiven over and over and over and over again. And that's a pretty amazing thing. But this kind of relationship that I'm describing here doesn't happen in the way that the world tells us that it happens. It doesn't happen by asserting what we want or demanding that we get our needs met or demanding what we think we deserve. In contrast, God intends that these relational needs that he's created in us, this need for connection and intimacy, that we desire in marriage come out of a commitment to goodness rather than demanding or asserting what we want or demanding what we think we should get. In practical terms, being committed to goodness, in my case, this means that I put what's in Christine's best interest over and above my own comfort level. See, it just came out. It did. I didn't have to look at it. That's a personal thing there. That means that I ought to be willing to put my own desires behind what's best for her. I'm not talking about compliance. I think compliance is about fear. It's about it's about going along with the program just to avoid the discomfort of conflict or for peace sake. But loving someone is a process of that can involve disagreement. It can involve having lively debate and differences of opinion. But it's about expressing those opinions and those feelings and those perspectives in a kind, respectful way. In effect, committing yourself to goodness is committing yourself to being a particular kind of person who values and strives after being kind, being loving, being respectful, being merciful, being honest, and being long-suffering. It requires great effort. It requires thoughtfulness. It requires paying attention, taking time to really know another person. That's one of the really interesting things that happens in marriage is that you really think that the way to love someone else is to love them the way that you want to be loved. And there's that doesn't work out that way. It requires patience and it requires wisdom. It just requires a lot of time and learning. As this commitment to goodness is lived out, a deeper trust develops. It enables those who are married, if both people are really committed to goodness and committed to being honest and loving and kind, to be open in ways that they hadn't experienced before. It can create a place of safety where people can be really open and vulnerable, and it can result in a real loving, open, intimate connection and can cultivate trust. So that's, I think, how the peace that God has given us married, has authored marriage as a way of responding to some emotional needs we have. But again, it doesn't happen by just demanding it or asserting your needs. It really happens by actually being a servant. It happens, and not compliance again, but by, or out of fear, but by being committed to goodness and being a loving person. Okay. The second part that I think is important here, and probably most important here about what God intends in marriage, is that there is this eternal need that we have. And marriage is different than other relationships just because of proximity and vulnerability and risk. Marriage confronts its participants with challenging situations every day. We have to decide about how we're going to interact with each other, because you have to interact with each other all the time. In those interactions, because we're broken, we're morally flawed, we will hurt each other, even when we don't want to, in ways that we never imagined ourselves capable of. And that's part of what I think God intends to happen in marriage, is that we see that, and we see ourselves hurting the person that we care about the most in ways we couldn't have imagined before. Hopefully, as that happens, we become convinced that we have this disease of our will and this disease of our heart, and that this condition, this disease, prevents me from being the very kind of person that I want to be. It infects my entire life. It infects how I relate to Christine, how I relate to my kids. And even when I don't want to hurt them, I do. And because of the proximity and the nature of the relationship, the marriage relationship, I experience firsthand my own failure, and I experience firsthand Christine's failure. I hurt her, she hurts me. That's what happens, even when we don't want to, even when we're committed to goodness, even when we have faith that we're personally committed to the truth. From God's perspective, experiencing failure and experiencing the consequences of failure is a crucial element to the maturing of our faith. And I'm going to define faith as, or the maturing of our faith as, the process of discovering what is true and becoming personally committed to it. That's how I'm defining the maturing of our faith. And God is very much invested in that process, and seeing to that happens in each of us. As we experience personal failure in our marriage, hopefully there's this divine metamorphosis that takes place inside of us. Our desires and our minds begin to be transformed, such that we actually come to desire goodness and begin to see reality from God's perspective. We come to actually hate the fact that we hurt each other. And let me describe the process of this. As His children, we come to recognize sin in us layer upon layer and our inability to manage it. Even though I have faith and I'm committed to goodness, that doesn't mean that I'm not going to be hurtful or not going to sin. So I get real clear about, even though I can't manage it as hard as I try. And marriage has this very unique way of making this evident. At the same time that God works in me and my desire for goodness increases and I understand what God is about and what goodness really is, there's this other dynamic that's alive in me, and that's this sin that I can't manage. The internal tension that created by these two opposing forces is exactly the experience that God has authored for me. There's no greater teacher than this kind of struggle. Whether we recognize our need for mercy depends on our willingness to see the truth about ourselves. The overwhelming message of the Bible is that God wants me to get is that I am my own worst problem, not Christine. And I think that I've been a marriage counselor for almost 25 years now, and the most significant problem that I see with people is this finger right here. People come in and they point the finger at the other person and they believe with their whole heart that the other person's the problem. And that finger destroys marriages more than anything else. Rather than saying, I'm my own worst problem, I'm responding wrongly, or I'm responding from my own fears or my own issues or whatever, I make the other person the problem. And that destroys marriages more than anything else, is blaming. Believing that someone else is my problem. Because it just escalates, and then it's just a war about who's right, and then you get more evidence to build your case that this other person is, in fact, your own worst problem. So God wants us to come to terms with this reality, this truth, that I, rather than someone else, is my problem. And God uses marriage to teach that lesson over and over and over again. We are not naturally prone to accept that truth as truth. We are allergic to it. We resist it. We are hardened against it. This is the natural state that human beings, that the Bible describes, the biblical authors describe this state of human beings. God marks us with his ownership by miraculously and dramatically opening up our minds and hearts to the truth. He does this in order that we might hear the truth, see the truth, and not turn away our eyes away from it. People who belong to God look at truth and see it as truth. And by divine miracle, we find ourselves open to the truth speaking to us and teaching us. Marriage provides the opportunity to walk closely alongside another person and have help in seeing what is difficult to see as they hold the mirror up to us. That's what marriage does. As God gives us eyes to see, and we respond to with humility by being open to the truth, rather than blaming, marriage provides the possibility of being seen, of being known, and loved in a way that is rare. Genuine intimacy comes from being welcomed and loved by another person when I am open about and present with my failure. True intimacy comes from giving and receiving mercy in the midst of failure. So in conclusion, I'm suggesting that God's primary purpose, his primary intent, is to use marriage as a mechanism for maturing our faith and fulfilling our eternal need to know the truth about ourselves, that is, to know our need for mercy and to come to want goodness. He does this in order that we might experience his love, his mercy, his grace, and that we might be welcomed into the kingdom. And that's the point of marriage. Questions about what I've said?
One of the biggest problems is the blaming finger that points at the other person.
Yes.
So what if you're right, though?
I think insisting that you're right is like walking on precarious ground. If you understand the biblical notion of depravity.
So is it certain?
Why is it so important that you're right?
Right. I guess to what extent does like the recognition of there being, I guess if there to be reconciliation, how can you have reconciliation if there is a problem but neither side is willing to acknowledge that there's a problem? And doesn't there have to be some sort of acknowledgement that there is a problem, or do you just like walk around blind, like, no problem, no problem, no problem? Like, you know, to what extent does there have to be some sort of recognition there is a problem?
I think that's what I'm saying, suggesting that God is actually committed to is that showing us that we are the problem. That will happen. It will happen. I mean, I guarantee you that if you get married, that your wife will tell you that there's a problem. and that you're part of it. I promise you. I think you brought up a good point, though, about this being right thing. And I think it's okay to believe that I'm right, but to insist that I'm right at the expense of the relationship and being a loving person is hurtful, and that would be wrong. So I think I can think I'm right, but
so being right doesn't necessarily mean you take it upon yourself to help the person fix the problem by simply pointing out how wrong they are. And like,
well, but see, when I'm insisting that I'm right, what the discussion comes about is about me proving that I'm right and they're wrong, rather than us having this debate about, well, here's what I think and here's what you think, and how to, you know, let's talk about that or dialogue about that or listen to each other in a respectful way. It becomes about my proving that I'm right. And discussions can go there really quickly. I mean, a lot of arguments between couples are about who's right and who's wrong, or who did it right or who did it wrong, kind of deal, and proving that and winning that argument.
So do you think if there's an instance where you see a fault in somebody else, do you think it's wise to not always bring that up at the time when, like, that's a crisis at the moment, like, to let that pass and to revisit it later in terms
of... I think
of
that can be appropriate. I think it requires wisdom. I don't know that there's a set answer for that. I think there are times when it's better for me to help Christine see things, and there's times where it's better for her to help me see things, and I think she knows those times, and I think I have a pretty good feel for those times, and it works better. And I think there are times where we let things go, or when we think it's important enough to help the person see, or then we talk about it. But it's how you talk about it that's more the issue than what you talk about.
Just add a couple things. That in my relationship with Jody, it's really clear when she's wrong. What's difficult is where am I wrong?
Right.
And I have never in my life experienced a time where she was wrong and I was right. I mean, I've experienced times when we're both wrong.
Right.
Where there's something about the way she's interacting with me is wrong, but inevitably, if I will face myself, I will ultimately come to recognize that there's something desperately wrong about the way I'm interacting with her or treating her, and my business is with me, not with her.
Right.
I need to worry about me and my relationship with God, my obedience to God, not her. My job is not to fix her. My job is to forbear her fallibility and her sinfulness, just as she forbears mine.
And part of the reason we want to fix other people is because we want to make it more comfortable for us, because they're making life uncomfortable for us and we want to be comfortable. And that's really what it's about. And that's not right. You know, that's selfish. Does that make sense?
Could you explain the difference between compliance and Christ-like forgiveness and servanthood? Could you maybe expound on how to avoid compliance? Because you said, well, we need to forgive.
Okay.
And
I was actually going to give you an example of forgiveness, and somehow I passed over it. I didn't see it. The word forgiveness means to let go. And my understanding of it is that it's a legal term, and it's basically letting go of my right to demand justice. And the reason that I do that is because I've been forgiven. God has let go of demanding justice or taking revenge, essentially, on me. What it means in practical terms is that I'm not going to take revenge. What that means, though, is that I'm not pretending that I really didn't get hurt. So forgiveness is a process of actually acknowledging that I've been hurt and not pretending that I didn't get hurt and actually deciding not to let go, not to take revenge. That's what forgiveness is. So forgiveness is very conscious in some ways. It's very thoughtful. It's very purposeful. And it's painful and it's difficult. The intent of compliance is to avoid discomfort. It's to not make waves, to not let it be a big deal, to act like it's not a big deal, just to be comfortable. So their intent is what's really, really different. And I define compliance as a willingness just to sort of give up myself, to not state what I think or feel. An example would be if I said to Dusty, hey, where would you like to go get a beer? And he said, I don't care. And he did. So compliance would be, he would say that because he might be afraid that I might be upset with him, or he might say something that would offend me, or he just wanted peace, and that's the point of compliance. Whereas forgiveness is real clear and it's honest about what's really true. Does that make sense? Okay.
I just had a couple questions. One was like, if you tend to desire peace.
Yes.
And so you're just pretty much passive about things, and you do as much as you can to prevent yourself from stating what your opinion is on things that you don't really matter. Is that okay, or would that be an example of unhealthy compliance?
It would depend. I can't. I think you'd have to look at your motives and what you really want and why you want it. But do I want peace because I don't want to be uncomfortable? Am I willing to be uncomfortable if God wants me uncomfortable? I think being a Christian is pretty uncomfortable because I have to deal with myself. And there's a lot of kind of internal conflict that goes on with being a Christian and being confronted with my own sin and being confronted with the truth of that. So I'm not sure being a Christian is comfortable. So I read the New Testament and I don't see a lot of comfort. Jesus' experience was difficult. The apostles' experiences were difficult. I'm not sure the point is to be comfortable.
Okay. Sort of balance off that, so like honesty versus being like, so are you saying that basically that we, that as, you know, if and when I get married, God forbid, that we ought to be able to be honest with each other and vent those frustrations to be sort of mirrored off of so that we can then take those and sort of internalize them?
I think it's really important to be honest, but I think it's probably more important to be loving. And you have to balance those two and weigh those two, because sometimes being honest can be hurtful. I think we're pretty twisted, perverted, messed up people. We don't see things right. And we can believe we're doing it right and be doing it wrong and be convinced that we're doing it right. So I think we really have to be careful and kind of think about why we're doing what we do and what we want, and we can think we're doing it right and maybe not. I think being loving is as important as being honest, maybe a little more important.
I'm thinking about the marriage being about sanctification rather than fulfillment.
Right.
And
I'm defining sanctification as this process of coming to value goodness, coming to want and see reality as God sees it, and struggling honestly with the sin in me, and yet coming to see my need for mercy, and this process where I'm discovering what is true and committing myself to it, that whole process. That's how I'm defining sanctification.
Okay, that probably answers my question. My question was going to be, what if one of you isn't participating in the sanctification element of basically not a Christian?
It makes it very difficult.
Thank you.
It's already difficult enough as it is, because you have two sinners living together. Even when they're committed to goodness, they hurt each other. But when you have a person that isn't committed to truth or committed to goodness or being honest with themselves about themselves and what they bring and how they're hurtful, that can be very painful. Very frustrating and very, very difficult.
Can you give me an example of when you'd be loving and dishonest? So I always considered the two, honesty and loving, kind of to go side by side with each other.
Well, I could be honest with Christine about a particular character flaw in her, for example. But why am I telling her that? Am I telling her that to hurt her? Am I telling her that to show her or prove to her that she's messed up? So it's my intent in telling her. What do I want from telling her? And I may be right about that character flaw, but again, what is my motive for telling her? I might be just wanting to prove that I'm right. Or I might wanting to get her to shut up because I don't want her to say something to me. I mean, I can have all kinds of motives for saying what I want to, for saying what I say. And it can be honest, but it can be hurtful.
Just on that same thing, you're not saying, though, that you would be, like, say something that wasn't true. You might omit saying, like, well, you have this character flaw, because that would be unloving to say that, but you wouldn't, like, say, oh, you don't, you wouldn't just, like, go out of your way and say, like, oh, you don't have this habit.
Well, that wouldn't be loving. If I understand what you're saying. Try me again. Maybe I'm not understanding what you're saying.
I want to make sure you're saying that, like, saying something that's true
right.
may not always be good.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that saying something untrue can be good.
I don't think that's loving.
I think we're... I just wanted to make sure that's what you're actually saying.
Yeah. I don't think it's right to tell someone something that's not true.
Right.
Because I think it's loving, or I want to believe that it's loving. I don't think that's loving.
Okay.
There's a phenomenon called reframing in the psychological community. And a reframe is a intervention that takes something that's really difficult and says it in a different way that makes it easier to or more palatable to say. And it's an intervention that's used a lot in psychotherapy. I think that's you have to be really careful with that kind of intervention. I think if you use that kind of intervention and take people away from what's true or away from reality, that you're actually hurting them. I think there are ways that you can reframe things that make things people can move into and grow into, like God works with us, but it needs to be moving towards reality rather than away from reality, moving towards what's true rather than away from what's true. Like we call homosexuality diversity. That would be an example of it. We call abortion pro-life or pro-choice. That's a reframe. There's lots of them. I think our culture is particularly adept at reframing things, calling evil good and good evil. And I think it's getting more and more difficult all the time because of that to know the difference.
So I have two questions. One's maybe a comment.
Okay.
You said that the biggest problem in relationships is the blaming.
Yes. Yeah, I did say that. Yeah, I did say that.
I wonder if you would comment or suggest that there's also a potential for somebody, and it's probably, because you're intertwined with blaming in a weird way, but there's the potential that in relationships someone might take the blame for everything.
Yes. That is a danger. I think responsibility is a huge issue in relationships, and oftentimes in relationships you have people who tend to make other people the fault, the problem, and there are people who actually take on the problem, and both are a serious problem because both are inaccurate.
Yeah, and how would that work in a healthy, sanctifying relationship?
That I'm willing to look at what's true, that I'm committed to looking at what's true, and as Christine tells me something that I'm, like, for example, that I'm being hurtful, that I'm willing to hear that and listen to that and learn from it.
Essentially, sometimes you want to see that you're not responsible.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, I'm evaluating it. I'm more likely to, I mean, in a, yes.
I mean, it's equally simple.
Absolutely. Yes, it is. Because if I take on responsibility for you that's not mine, I'm enabling you not to take responsibility for yourself. And that's not a good thing. Because God wants us to deal with what's true and what's real. And the fact is that I'm responsible for my choices, my decisions, whether I'm loving, whatever, and you are for you.
The difference between forgiveness and compliance was discussed, but
yes.
Could you talk about the difference between submission and compliance?
Can I?
Will you?
Well, I think they're very different. I think the motivation for compliance is fear. It's a way that I manage my comfort level. I don't say what I think or feel or want because I don't want you to be angry with me if I do. So my compliance or my complicity then is just a way of managing. It's kind of a subtle, dishonest way of controlling in a sense. It's harder to see it as that, but it's really about being in control. And it's not honest, and I don't really think ultimately it's trusting God. The whole submission thing, I don't know that I really understand that completely. I don't think it's what we think it is. I'm pretty much convinced of that. I don't think it's about authority. I think it's about responsibility. That's what I think about it so far. That this relationship between husband and wife, I think we all have responsibility, but I think I have a responsibility to be a loving person. It's not like I get the last word. I don't think that's what it means. But haven't unpacked all that yet. That doesn't make sense to me. I mean, yeah.
Seems like it fits with what you said earlier, that a lot of what your marriage is about is learning how to put the other person ahead of you.
Yes.
And that when the Bible talks about submitting to one another in love,
right,
that's kind of the picture of really working at being responsible,
right,
and being willing to set aside myself in order to care about someone else.
Right. I think in the same context of Paul talking about, I think it's Ephesians 5 where he talks about women being submissive, he talks of husbands loving their wives as Christ loved the church. Do you know what that's about? Do you have any ideas? You don't want to go there?
It's a whole lecture.
It is a whole lecture. That's part of why.
And I think it's coming up.
Oh, is it? Okay, good.
Oh, it's not going to be in this term. That one got cut.
This has so much to do with, I think, John's question. But maybe from a little bit different angle. The idea that, like, in a relationship with someone, you're talking about how, you know, it's so much about your sanctification and about you're not pointing out the faults and problems of the other person, but really your own faults and problems. But with the issue of, like, when you do recognize a fault or a problem in the person you're in a relationship with, and I'm thinking outside just marriage, like,
right.
Just like, how do you deal with that in a loving way? Because I don't think you can ever get rid of your own motivations and that,
right,
your own evil motivations that you want them to stop for somewhat your own comfort.
Sure.
When they have some character issue that, like,
right,
I mean, it's not only impeding your relationship with them, but you see it, you know, damaging other
places. Sure.
And you know you have them too, and
sure,
I'm sure you don't help their problems or whatever, but how do you do that in a, how do you, be part of their sanctification and also helping them towards truth and towards their own sanctification without being...
Right. Well, in reality, it's hopefully it's what I do for a living. I'm a counselor, and what I try to help people do is see what they don't see because it's getting in the way and they're hurting each other, that kind of thing. So, but a lot of it depends on the relationship. A lot of it depends on whether or not they're really open to seeing it. And a lot of it means developing a relationship and having a relationship where you have a voice with them, where you can say things to them, where there's some trust that they actually believe that you have their best interest at heart. And part of it is communicating in a way that's actually loving and knowing them to a degree that you can try or strive to say it in a loving way. That's a very difficult thing to do because it takes time to get to know people. And some, you know, what you could say with one person who might be loving, you could say the other thing to another person that wouldn't be loving because of who they are or what their background is or whatever. So you kind of have to, it's very personal, it's very individual, and it requires time and thought and wisdom, and it's...
Is that okay to do?
It's not easy. It's messy.
Is that okay to do in a marriage, like to point out those things?
Is it okay to point that things out?
Yeah, especially like in a marriage, like some, where
sure,
someone you know them, obviously,
yes,
relatively well.
Yes, I think it's important. I think it's it's what Christine and I do in terms of I think she's committed to goodness and she wants to see how she's hurtful. I certainly want to see how I'm hurtful. There are moments where I don't, but I come back to it, and I want to see that. I want to know that, and because I don't want to hurt her, and I don't want to hurt myself. So, sure.
This question is kind of related to two things that you've said. You were talking about a qualitative difference between a marriage and
right.
a not married relationship, and you
right.
also mentioned like just homosexuality in passing.
Right.
And I agree with everything that you're saying about like relationships and all that.
Right.
How do you talk about what it is that's specific to marriage other than close proximity? Because obviously, like, anybody can live together. So
anybody can what?
Anybody could live together.
Yes. Are you referring specifically to homosexuality or contrasting homosexuality with heterosexuality?
I'm thinking both of that
okay.
and then of, like, say, like, I live in this house and there are girls and guys in this house and we all live together and interact
right.
all the time.
Right.
So I guess I'm asking, like, in both of those
okay.
situations,
okay.
can you clarify what you mean?
Again, I don't think that God is limited by the fact that you are single. The process of sanctification is limited. I think there is a kind of vulnerability that happens in marriage that doesn't happen in singleness, that is more personal, it's more vulnerable, and it's kind of ratcheted up a bit, but it doesn't. God isn't limited by whether a person's married or not. Okay, so there's a different quality to it. I think if you were married, you'd know what I was talking about.
Well, I think my question is actually, what is the qualitative difference? I mean, that's why I connected it in my mind with homosexuality.
Well, I think
like,
there's a kind of vulnerability that happens in marriage because of the nature of marriage, because of sexuality is part of it, because of the kind of vulnerability that can come from the commitment in marriage and the kind of trust that can be developed over time that doesn't happen with singles.
So this is sort of like really theoretical, but I'm presenting a paper
right.
next weekend about
right.
homosexuality, so this is why I'm asking about this.
Okay.
What is your perspective on
okay.
the difference between, like,
right.
let's say, like, a committed, open, intimate relationship between,
right.
like, a homosexual couple
okay.
and a heterosexual couple?
Okay. I think that it's easier for men to understand men than it is for men to understand women, and it's easier for women to understand women than it is for women to understand men and be open with them. And I think what God wants is for us to struggle to be loving, for it to not be easy, and that this is the way that God designed it, for men and women to be together rather than men and men and women, because, I mean, there's a kind of almost clenched fist, I think, about homosexuality that says, no, I'm going to be it on my terms, and I'm not going to be vulnerable, as vulnerable as I could be with the opposite sex that I am with the same sex.
So it's more difficult.
Absolutely, I think so.
Okay.
I mean, you think about it. You understand the girls here, the other women here on the floor, than you do men because you're a woman. It's easier. but you understand. She's the exception. But you understand what I'm saying, what I'm getting at. Yeah. You would understand why another woman would feel some of the stuff that you would...
Yeah.
Yeah. And guys are clueless. And same things for guys. But there's a vulnerability that happens with heterosexual marriage that doesn't happen in homosexual relationships. And I think that's part of what God has in mind. He wants us to figure out and work at loving someone that's different than we are. It's not the same.
I might just speak a little bit more to the qualitative difference as well. It seems to me that you can be in really close proximity with other people without signing on to this lifelong commitment to really know the other person and
right.
interact with them in an intimate way.
Right.
Similarly, with myself as an unmarried person, I have friendships in which I can be really vulnerable and really known, but it's not on a day-to-day level.
Right.
And it's a very different thing because they don't have to live with me.
That's right. And I think there's something different about, Christine knows me because she lives with me and I go home. My kids know me. You guys don't know me like they know me because I can act one way here, but I can act a whole different way at home. They know me. You understand what I'm saying? Day in and day out. What's that?
I'm getting to know you.
Well, that's okay. Well, you know that's true.
And even 4 years.
We act different in public than we do in private. That's what I'm talking about.
Well, isn't that the biggest problem? You know, you think you want to get married to someone. You see him, let's say, in this beautiful room surrounded by all these people. He's really nice and,
you're
going to places. You don't know him.
That's right.
And then you get married and all the fairy tale breaks.
And, see, that's right. But that's exactly right. But the bigger problem and the problem that God is more concerned about is that I don't know myself. And he wants me to know me. He wants me to know to learn about what's true about me and what's true about him. That's the bigger problem. But it takes time, and I think there's going to be a section here on how to think about a marriage partner. Is that right? Where's Nancy?
Yes.
Yes. So I think that issue is going to be talked about. But the bigger problem is me, not somebody else. Am I open? Am I honest? Kind of thing with myself.
So
or am I hiding?
Would you agree that marriage is giving and not always accepting, waiting for something in return, and marriage is self-sacrifice?
And if people are committed to what's good, but I've seen a lot of marriages where people are committed to taking, and they've been horrible. I mean, occasionally I ask people, why are they married? Because they dislike each other so much. I mean, I'm not suggesting that they get a divorce. I just want to know what they're doing because they hate each other and they say it.
Sorry to bug again. Just on another note, it seems like maybe I'm wrong. Let me ask you to tell me whether I am. But like, it seems like you're saying that also with this constant conflict that we sort of, our focus becomes less on ourselves and more on our God and other people.
Say that again?
That through this conflict and stuff, that hopefully that our focus becomes less on our own desires and more on other people and God? And like a truer version of ourselves? And
well,
a truer version of ourselves?
I don't know that I would say it that way.
Okay.
I think the focus, I mean, if we're talking about sanctification, mm-hmm. I become more clear about what is good and what God thinks about stuff and how he sees stuff. And I become clearer about myself. And so, I mean, part of that, so there's a sense in which I'm still focused on myself. I'm focused on seeing myself and being honest with myself. But I'm also focused, and part of the goodness thing is that I become more and more committed to the or see the value of goodness, so that certainly is going to play itself out in the choices that I make with, for example, people that I have to interact with, or Christine or my kids.
I guess I misasked that. I was just curious if, like, because when you get into a relationship and then you get married and things like that, people say make God the center of your relationship.
Oh.
The thing that I was curious about is how much we can enjoy each other and versus how much we can enjoy God, whether God is more of an individual thing, whether he should be the center of your relationship and everything that you enjoy about each other should be godly oriented, or whether we are supposed to take joy in that person because they're that person rather than that person because of their direct relation to God. I
don't know how you separate all that out. I think part of taking joy in the other person is understanding that they're created in God's image, that they're a gift, that they're unique, that I'm called to be a loving person. So I don't know how you separate that out.
It seems like it takes a long time to get to a place where you can't separate that out.
Right. Where you cannot separate that out?
Right.
Yes.
Because I think it just takes a whole lot of maturity, a whole lot of years to really see the integration
right.
of God and my joy in life or my joy in you.
Right.
And so I think it can be a very
I think it takes
made up thing.
Made up thing?
Made up.
Yeah.
Fake thing to try to enjoy God in you in the beginning of my relationship. I just don't have
right.
anywhere near a clue what that means.
Right.
And it just seems like there's more and more of a watercolor of life where the colors are all merging as we get older.
Right.
But certainly, in the beginning, there is a whole lot of benefit in just finding joy in each other.
Right.
Just for the people we are. And there's a whole lot of growth in finding joy in or acceptance of you as a different person than myself. And the focus of just the individuals. Apart from understanding how God even is a part of that, if I'm really focusing on you and accepting you and forgiving you, that ends up bringing about that merging to an organic reality. It isn't about some spiritualized language or spiritualized thing that I'm trying to make happen. It seems like God, right. over time, with my commitment
right.
to the truth about myself and to loving you in lots of the ways you've said
right.
really makes that come about.
Right.
That makes sense?
Mm-hmm. You said it well.
I had one other comment.
Okay.
Actually, I have 50 comments. I'm his wife. we were talking about putting the needs of another person before my own. And I think that can be so easily misunderstood. And I think the way I thought about it early on was like I would cook for you or I would make sure I did something for you was kind of the idea of putting your needs before my own. And sometimes, I mean, I think putting your needs before my own is really a very simplified version of how do you love. And love is a very intangible, extremely difficult gray area to figure out. And that, again, takes a tremendous amount of time.
Experience.
Experience and years to figure out
right.
what in the world it means to even put my needs before yours.
Right.
Excuse me. There it is. That's the goal. Put your needs before mine. And sometimes...
Because you don't even have any idea what's going on.
I don't have a clue.
Right.
I mean, and I think that was really a great way to start it, Larry, was... Of course we don't have a clue when we start out with marriage. We think we do,
right.
but there's no way possible. And I have a lot of getting over myself, figuring myself out and giving over myself, I mean, all the time. But focusing more on this, putting my needs after yours, may look like I'm putting my needs before yours.
Yes.
Today, I had all this stuff to do, and I decided to stop and take a bike ride. I could have made a better dinner tonight.
Right.
Actually, I made a pretty good dinner, but that's a good
Right.
But my deciding to take a bike ride comes out of a recognition of my need that I really need space and time and some fresh air and some exhilaration and some good smells and my body working and having that sense of freedom and openness and so the light, because it's in that place where I have more space to love you.
Right.
And it could look like I was just being selfish and I didn't go along with you in something that you were doing today that was really important. It could look like I wasn't a very supportive wife. And
right.
So I think that
right.
it's so not simple.
It's not simple.
To do the kinds of things that you're talking about. And I think that's the genius behind what you're saying, is this is so not simple.
Right. And we don't have any idea how not simple it is.
We don't have any idea.
Right.
But the neat thing is, God does it anyway.
Correct.
I mean, I'm not very smart, and I'm not very... I don't have a lot of extra great stuff going for me. God does. And it just took a ton of years for me to be able to think about what it is.
It takes a lot of not doing it right.
Pardon me?
It takes a lot of not doing it right. A lot of failure.
Mostly.
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 Right.
Your failure. And something that Carl said...
You're getting to know me better, Jack. You're getting to know me even better.
Yeah. No, Jack's different, though. Something that Carl said, should we be dishonest? And I don't know if you ever really directly said this, but you weren't suggesting to be dishonest.
No.
You were suggesting to be honest, and that's what loving is.
Right.
But you don't always say everything.
Right. That's what I was trying to
say. Is that enough commentary?
That's good.
Do you think that such a thing exists as irreconcilable differences?
I think that there are, sadly and tragically, times where there is no marriage, that a marriage is dead, that there's no commitment, that there's no commitment to another person or commitment to goodness or commitment to looking at yourself. I think there are tragically times where there isn't a marriage, where people are legally have a contract, but there's no marriage. I think that's a rationalization for not wanting to work it out, because I don't know anybody that's more different than Christine and I. I mean, we share a lot of things. We share our faith, we share our commitment to goodness, we share our children, we share a lot of really good things, a lot of good things. But we are really, really different. And if I didn't, if I wasn't committed or I wanted whatever, I could say, I could use irreconcilable difference as an excuse to simply say, I don't want to do this, I don't want to work. That's what I think irreconcilable differences are. It's a rationalization. I think marriage is really, really hard, and it's really, really good. It's the hardest thing you'll do.
What would you,
the best thing. Yeah.
What would you say in the case of like a mental illness?
I think we're all mentally ill. Our culture defines mental illness as how you feel. I define mental illness as a person's ability to function in reality as God designs it and has created it. And I think we all struggle with that to some degree or another.
So you don't think they exist?
Do I think what?
So, like...
Mental illness doesn't exist?
Like schizophrenia?
Oh, I think that exists. That's a...
Okay. But it's a diversion of reality.
Continuum. Are you just asking to...
I guess I'm just saying, like, would you so you're saying that would be an irreconcilable difference that's kind of farther down the line? Like,
no, I don't, I think if somebody's, just because somebody's mentally ill is not a reason to not be married to them. I know, I work with lots of mentally ill people who have tremendous courage and who are committed to figuring out what's true. I think, did you have your hand? Okay.
This question doesn't directly follow from anything you said, but it was prompted by another question.
Okay.
I have a close friend who has had two babies with a guy who she's not married to.
Okay.
And she has since broken up with him, and now having some space and distance from the relationship, she kind of looks at him with new eyes as like, why was I ever attracted to him? What was I thinking?
Right.
And has no desire to get back together with him.
Right.
And I've listened to Dr. Laura a few times, who always says that, you know, like, they need to take responsibility for these two people that they've brought into the world, and the right thing to do would be to get married. And that, like, I don't know how to encourage her, because that's just such a difficult thing for
and
me to say.
She's listening to Dr. Laura?
No. Well, I don't know if she is. That's just, okay. like, the influence that I've had of when, like, thinking of myself as trying to give her advice.
Okay.
But I don't know, like, how to, like, what to do in that kind of situation. Like, how to be responsible, how, I don't know.
Well, that's a complex question. I mean, I can't answer your question. I mean, like, simply. I can tell you that I think Dr. Laura is a Pharisee. I think she has a lens that she looks at life through, and it's kids and taking care of kids, and it affects everything that she says and does, or a lot of what she says or does. And I think that can skew what is wise and what is best. So I think you have to look at each case individually, each situation individually, each person. It may not be that, I mean, I don't know that two wrongs make a right, or, I mean, you understand what I'm saying?
So
I think it's great that she's looking at why she did what she did and how she got there, but it doesn't mean because she had two children with this guy that she should marry him. If he's not committed to her, or, I mean, I don't even want to go any farther than that, because I don't know, and I'm not sure I would even tell her what to do as much as I would try to help her figure out what would be wise and help her come to those decisions and take responsibility for herself, rather than say, you should do this or this or this.
Yeah, I haven't...
Well, I'm not saying you have, but...
No,
I'm just saying...
I'm afraid to say anything like that. That's...
But I don't...
What were you going to say?
I have some strong feelings about Dr. Laura.
Yeah. It's good to have some...
I think she can be really, really harsh and unkind to people, and cruel, and that bothers me a lot. I think you can be honest with people and kind, but she is like, she can tear somebody down in a second, and she's pretty presumptuous at times, I think. She misses a lot, and I don't know, I'm doing the soapbox about Dr. Lauren. I don't know if, you know.
Well, that was helpful to balance that out a little bit, because I definitely recognize that in a lot of the advice that she gives, it's so much focused on the needs of the children, where she's missing the needs of the adults, and where getting married might
be. She's kind of so, she can't see the forest for the trees sometimes.
Yeah.
She's so focused on this one thing. I think it's time to stop. Thank you very much. Good questions.